Western Slope author Craig Childs has spent 35 years exploring this landscape and the universe above it. Today, on Local Motion, Craig joins us to talk about his new book, The Wild Dark, a bike trek from the Las Vegas Strip into the Mojave Desert, and a meditation on what we lose when we lose the night sky. We'll also talk with filmmaker Ben Clark about his film Preserved and what restoration looks like at every scale, from Ted Turner's 560,000-acre ranch in northern New Mexico to your own backyard. If you want to see Craig Childs live, he'll be at the Montrose Pavilion on Tuesday, April 7th. Doors are at 6:30, shows at 7, and tickets at sherboneau.org. And if you can't catch us for this full episode today, no worries. You can find this full Local Motion episode online under the News tab at kbnf.org, or just search KBNF Local Motion on Spotify. Okay, here's Craig Childs. I'd like to start. I'd like to assume that everybody in our listening area knows who you are, but maybe not. Could I please just have you introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what do you do, and kind of who are you to the Western Slope?
Well, hi. Hey. My name is Craig Childs, and I've moved from the outskirts of one town to the next around Western Colorado for about 35 years now. So I've lived outside of Ouray and Ridgeway, Crawford, Hotchkiss, and now Norwood. So I'm making a long, slow migration around this part of the world.
Was that the sequence? Ouray, Ridgeway, then North Fork, then the West End?
Yeah, that's where I am. That's where I've gone. Those
cool.
are my tracks. And I write. I write books. Generally, they're around the Southwest, but sometimes they're around the world. So they're adventure, travel, experiential, science, wilderness. I never quite know how to describe them. I write books and I explore, and whatever I do leads to writing, it seems.
But it seems fair to say that your books are often about place.
Yes, they're always about place in one way or another. They're giving context to what's happening in a place, what happened there 1,000 years ago, a million, a billion, what's happening there now. So I go through a lot of frames of time, you know, where I'm really diving into fossil records and environmental records and ice cores and what people were doing here a century ago, 1,000 years ago. So I'm going into places and really getting into their history and also the sensory experience of being there, the real tactile experience of being on the ground, because I think it's really about places, about actual feeling a place.
You talked about time just now, and you mentioned that you can stand in a place and be there at the moment and think about what people were doing there 100 years ago or 1,000 or longer ago. And I've heard you talk about that before. And in your new book, you are gazing upward. Would you just tell our audience about your new book and what you contemplate there?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a book called The Wild Dark, and it's a exploration of dark skies, also bright skies. It's a combination. It's a bike trek through the outback north of Las Vegas. So biking out of Vegas, off of the Vegas Strip during the Formula One Grand Prix race. Not planned, and then out into the Mojave Desert, where night by night I could record and watch the change as we're leaving a major light source and going into the darkest place, and biking was the right pace, so that I could watch the change every night, as opposed to walking, where I wouldn't notice it would change, but night by night, I really wanted to see the contrast. So I went out for 9 completely different nights, 200 miles biking, and it became this book.
I wonder if, when you think about time and place, did you have that same experience when you look at the night sky? Do you ever think about time at an even bigger scale than just Earth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't help but think about the largest scales of time when you're looking up, that you're extending into kind of an unknown time that goes beyond human recognition, that goes on beyond generations, beyond history, beyond the history of the planet. You know, you're looking into the millions and billion years. You're looking into the trillions of light sources, but it all comes at once. You're not really defining it by numbers. I mean, you can, you know, in this book, I break it down to, you know, here are the numbers of stars we're looking at. Here are the numbers that aren't visible. But it's more of an emotional, sensory experience of time where you're looking up into the sky and your eye disappears into infinity. And infinity is just packed full. There's stuff from here to forever. And last night I was sleeping on the out by Green River, Utah, out in the desert, and I took my computer out. I set up a little office on the side of this canyon. I was driving home and needed to stop and do some work, and dusk came and it blotted out my computer, blotted out the sky, and I had to stop working, because the stars were coming out and I just couldn't keep staring into this bright blue light of my laptop. And I had to close it and look up, because it's just like, you know what? All of that is going on up there. This sense of time that you're mentioning, it's like, why would I be staring at a laptop screen when forever is happening right over my head?
So I personally, I'm with you. I love the feelings that you are describing, and I try to experience them. But you've taken the time and great effort to write it down and try to communicate it to people. Why do you do that?
I suppose it's some illness, some genetic mistake in my head that makes me need to do this.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, is there something you're trying to accomplish by sharing that with other people that maybe they don't have the same perspective and you hope they will, or something like that?
In an ideal sense, yeah. I tell stories because I see incredible things out there, and I come back and go, oh my God, you need to know about this. You need to witness that. And I admire just as much people who don't do that, who go out and experience things fully and come back quietly into the world. I'm just not one of those. I'm a storyteller, so I have to come back and say, you're not going to believe what I saw last night. You're not going to believe the stars. And I really write for people to remember, because when I see the stars, I remember the stars. And then I come back and go, I don't know if you guys remember. I just remembered last night. And let me tell you about my memory to stir your, you know, you have seen this before. You have felt everything that I've written. People who read it have felt. They know what I'm talking about, and I'm just there to remind them.
And do you hope that those people might behave differently or act different, treat our land differently? Is there any lower motivation in sharing your perspective with so many people?
Yeah. I'm hoping that seeing the context of things, seeing the time scales involved, the so many different elements of the environment, the nature of a place, that they will understand that, oh, that's not just going to be there. That's not going to be intact unless something changes. And so I'm really writing for everybody. I'm writing for people who don't have environmental inclinations, so that when they read it, they'll go, oh, yeah, A and B are connected. I just thought it was B. And that's what I'm wanting to do is connect the dots for people, where they realize how much our actions change things, how outsized the human sphere really is, because we influence our world on a scale that really nothing else does besides the sun and the seasons. We are a major player here, and it's easy to forget that and just think, oh, we're just on this earth and we're doing our thing, but we have a significant impact. And when we change our minds about something, it has a real world effect. And so I'm leaning toward this. I'm saying, if we're going to change your mind, try changing it in this direction.
Let's talk about that in terms of dark skies.
Mm-hmm.
This is a place where the majority of the population lives in places where they cannot see the Milky Way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know any statistics about this, but it wouldn't surprise me if maybe the majority of people alive today haven't seen the Milky Way.
Yeah, the number right now, the going number is 80% of people on Earth are in a place where the Milky Way can't be seen. And that would suggest that it, somewhere near 80% of people have never seen it. And you know, when in this book where I interview people who saw it for the first time, that's, you know, those are some powerful moments. And I was fortunate, many of us were fortunate to live in places where we were seeing it early on and we're used to that. And my question in this book is, what does it do to us not to see that? You know, you don't even have to know what the Milky Way is. You don't have to know any astronomy. All you have to do is look up and go, whoa, what's going on up there? And to lose that, to lose half of our reality, the night sky, I think that has a significant effect on human psyche, on the way we see the world and ourselves.
Okay, so that's missed human experience, missed human perspective. But there are other effects of the way we light the world. Like what?
Oh, so many. It really disturbs our circadian rhythm, which is what drives most of our metabolic life. Every cell in our body has a circadian cycle that is matched to the daylight and night. And we're metabolically different creatures at night than we are during the day. We have different chemicals in our blood. And when you throw that out, well, first, cancers start appearing. Light becomes a toxin. Excess light is a known toxin. And we have excess light.
But pause just for a second, yeah. Because for some people that might sound like a cuckoo, way out, wacky thing to say.
Yeah, well, it's a crazy thing that too much light can kill you. But too much darkness can kill you. You need both. You need light and dark, and our bodies are set up for this. Everything that has evolved on Earth has evolved, well, other than cave creatures and deep sea, but has evolved to light and dark, this shift. And it's this metabolic shift where you start producing different hormones at different times. But when you interrupt that hormone process and you start misfiring, you get spontaneous creations of cancers. It's in humans, it's in frogs, it's in everything. So light in itself, it is not a toxin. It's excess light that becomes toxic.
It's the missing the dark.
Yeah. Yeah. So you need both. You need light and you need darkness. But to have just one throws our systems into disarray, and disarray leads to everything going wrong.
So we have missed human experience. We have direct health effects. How about the non-human impacts?
Oh, significant. Just birds alone. Migration of birds is dramatically affected by excess light. Any stationary source of light changes their navigational patterns because birds that navigate at night are primarily queuing off of Polaris, the North Star, which is a fairly faint star, but it's the one that doesn't move in the sky. So it's in the Northern Hemisphere, it's their standard. That's what they pay attention to. And when we create these lights on the ground all over the place, we are throwing them everywhere. And it's not just them. It's every organism is affected by this. I've looked at the migration of grasshoppers and beetles and
tarantulas.
Yeah, tarantulas. These things are all dramatically changed by light. And it's not just the navigation. It's in birds. The light actually damages them, the same way it would humans. It changes the circadian rhythm, and they are reproducing at the wrong times. They're having chicks in a season where they can't feed them. So the Earth has just never had this much light before, and nothing here is made for this.
So here we are. We have created this ability to make as much light as we humans want now. And especially with the advent of LEDs, the cost to operate lights has gotten extremely low. There's no longer a strong financial incentive mm-hmm. to turn them off.
Yeah.
It's still there. But so where do we go from here? What can we do? It's easy for me to step out into my dark backyard and appreciate it, or ask my neighbor maybe to turn off their porch light. But this is we're talking about billions of people's habits.
Right. Right. But it is changing, because these habits are based on, right now with the advent of LEDs, and that's new. I don't think our habits are that hard to change the other direction. And there are a number of lighting engineers, architects that I spoke with about this, who are saying our understanding of light is really changing, the need for light, the different colors, that we don't need to blast things out with light to have them be safe. And they're basically saying we could cut our light use down to a half or a third of what it is and realize how much better this is biologically, health-wise, and how much just better it is for your experience. And we can do that place by place by place, your house, the community you're in. It could be a dark sky community, or I went to some communities that resisted, that went away from the dark sky designations, but continued to work on dark skies. So it doesn't have to be a designated town. It can also be just a community effort. So it's handled really differently in different places, but getting involved in your community as an advocate for dark skies changes the community. I saw that in Norwood, that when Norwood became a dark sky community, the first one on the Western Slope, I believe, there were laws that went on the books that have never been tested. They're just there to mitigate the impact of light. But mostly it was light started going out when we started talking about it. When we started going, hey, isn't this nice to have darkness? And people's lights who I know are anti-dark sky.
Or maybe just anti-regulation.
They're anti-regulation. So they're not anti-dark sky. That's a really good definition there. It's anti-regulation. And they turn their lights off too, because it's about preserving the ambiance of the night. It's not blinding ourselves. And I think that's what we all want. Maybe there's some who want it all lit up all night, but we all appreciate the darkness.
You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm your host, Brody Wilson. This week, we're talking with local author Craig Childs and filmmaker Ben Clark. If you're just tuning in, you can listen to Local Motion online by looking for Local Motion under the news tab at kvnf.org, or by searching for KVNF Local Motion on Spotify. Craig Childs isn't just a witness to the natural world. He's also been a guide in someone else's story. Filmmaker Ben Clark recently brought his documentary Preserved to the Western Slope, and Craig plays a prominent role in the film. I sat down with Ben Clark to talk about his film, The Land It Celebrates, and what restoration looks like, not just on a 500,000-acre ranch in northern New Mexico, but in our own backyards here on the Western Slope.
The film is called Preserved, and it's going to take you on a journey into a 560,000-acre piece of land in northern New Mexico that is the pinnacle of conservation today and functions like a living laboratory.
Wow, the pinnacle of conservation and a living laboratory. So this ranch is called Vermejo, and really, what is Vermejo? Tell us, if you can, quickly, what is the story of Vermejo? How did it come to be?
You know, Vermejo is a piece of land similar to so many that we find in the Southwest that had incredible indigenous history, incredible natural history, which of course included, extraction and nature turning into production. And then in around 1900, someone purchased it, and it just kept staying this really large parcel of land. And eventually in 1996, it was brought back under individual ownership after having been bought from Pennzoil by Ted Turner. And in 30 years, a team of scientists, biologists, and all of these conservationists, NGOs, governmental agencies like New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, Colorado Parks and Wildlife, have accomplished some of the most impossible tasks you can imagine and created a vision, an actual factual living laboratory, like I said, but a real vision for the future. I mean, this can be our future if we're choosing to have an amazing globe full of wonderful landscape optimized for animals and vegetation to thrive. That's what you find there. And this film takes you on that journey to it and leaves you filled with the same hope that inspired these people to do that great work.
Help a layperson who's not a conservationist understand how Vermejo might be different than any other large piece of preserved land, be that a national park or a national conservation area, even national forest. How is this different?
Well, similar to those areas you referenced, like national parks and large national monuments, it has the scale. But contrasting to that, its success is due to private conservation, where privately they don't suffer from some of the decision-making fatigue that can happen when you've got to balance a landscape for both public use and also for the wildlife. And how it's different is that without that human pressure, it's like you've walked back 300 years. You really can't believe the amount of animals you might see in an hour there. It is just mind-blowing.
Ben described what a visitor might actually experience if they rode a horse into the middle of Vermejo Ranch.
If you were to go sit down for an afternoon in the middle of that ranch and in a particular spot, you might, like let's say you went to a place called Castle Rock at 9,000 feet. If you were to sit on that rock, not only would you find brine shrimp in tiny pools, but you would watch at 9,000 feet in the trees, you would watch a herd of over 100 pronghorn start running around, right? And they're living in the trees. They came up from the prairie years before and adapted and found a way to live up there in an environment that's not incumbent to their success. You would see bison roaming around you in that same spot. I mean, probably a herd of maybe up to 400. And then if you stay there maybe toward dusk or you've been there toward dawn, there's a chance probably if you're looking out toward those trees, you will see a bear or maybe a mama bear and her cubs. All of those happen in the same day, every day on Vermejo in that particular spot. Mountain lions are bobcats, like all the big ungulates that we love and the predators that we're so fascinated by in the American West would be present in that same spot, you know, within a 24-hour period.
Craig Child spent several days at Vermejo while filming Preserved and found something he hadn't expected. In the movie, there's some moments where you are interacting with archaeological sites. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what your experience of that is, whether you're in Vermejo or in your own backyard in Norwood or the Dolores River Canyon, and you come across evidence of people who were here before us.
Yeah. Yeah, it really gives a sense of what this place is made of. Cause like at Vermejo, I'd always been wondering what was out a little farther. Cause I was more in the Pueblo world and Taos to Chaco to, you know, that kind of black and white pottery, that was happening 1,000 years ago. And I'd never really followed it farther east. And Vermejo is kind of on the horn of the Rockies that's sticking out between the Great Plains and the rest of the Southwest. And to get there and see that, oh, there are pit house structures. There is black on white pottery here. It connects to all these other places. I can connect from there all the way down to the Sea of Cortez and Baja because the shells that were ending up there. And so I end up stitching the land together physically, seeing these landmarks and going, okay, this is where people lived at this point. Then 1,000 years ago, this is where people lived off on the horizon. And you know, you're not so alone. I feel like with history, we feel like we're at the pinnacle of history, and it's this very lonely place where being out there, I see these sites and I see that, oh, we're connected to ages and ages and ages, and it doesn't end with us. There will be a 10,000 years from now. there will be a future. It will come, whatever it looks like, and we will have left our record as well. And that gives me a context. I'm sitting inside of time rather than being at the pinnacle of time.
The film Preserved makes a hopeful case that this kind of restoration isn't limited to billionaires and half-million-acre ranches. Ben Clark thinks it scales all the way down to your backyard.
You know, this is why I'm so excited that people come to this film and see it, is that this is actually a partnership between a private landowner and his organizations and Colorado Parks and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, numerous different researchers from several different universities. This place has been driven by science, funded in part, of course, by private ownership. But, you know, private landowners can't do this as successfully without that governmental input, without all these amazing partners. So really, Vermejo is this case of showing how if you care about how our private or how our public lands are managed, and you certainly, I mean, I love having all of this abundant wildlife everywhere, then looking at the parameter, looking at what happens when that wildlife moves potentially off of public land, and starting to look at what private landowners, if they choose to learn and if they can afford to help with some of the subsidies available, what they can do to help those that wildlife continue to thrive as soon as they're on their landscapes.
So if one wealthy landowner can do this for one tract of land in Northeast New Mexico, where do we go from here?
Well, the best part of this answer is going to be, we're already there. There are so many conservation organizations. Look in your Google where you are in your location and just add conservation to that and start seeing who pops up. You have got local community successes springing up all around you. You know, scientists and biologists are achieving massive successes on the ground today in conservation and in agriculture. Agriculture is actually the friend of conservation. You know, there are different practices being explored today in agriculture right now that are certainly going to make for a much better future for all of us. But the key issue here is we've got to be telling these bigger stories. We've got to be reaching bigger audiences and looking for community in all of this.
Yeah. Craig Childs had a similar message when I asked him the same question.
I agree that this film is really positive. You walk away from it going, oh, there are good things happening, and it's scalable. You know, you don't have to be Ted Turner. You don't have to have that much land. You can just be here and you can pick up trash. You can do whatever, you know, planting, cutting, whatever the land needs to not be destroyed, to not have us rake everything out of it. And it can happen on so many scales. In fact, I think it's better if it happens on a personal scale, because there are a lot of us. And, you know, there's backyard to parks to riverside. And, you know, there, just look for how you could make a place better. I mean, that's how I think about places when I camp there. I go, okay, pick up a piece of trash or something. At least walk away with some improvement to this place. As far as Preserved, I'd say to watch this film and look at the piece of land that they're talking about and then put that over here. See where we are on our landscape, because it's not just about that place in Northeast New Mexico. It's also about here in the North Fork. It's about Western Colorado. It's about everywhere. Just take the boundaries of that piece of land and put them around Peonia or put them around Norwood and look at that land there and go, okay, what here needs to be restored? What here can be in a greater natural state? What can we take care of?
What can we take care of? That's Craig Childs, local author, and filmmaker Ben Clark. Craig's new book, The Wild Dark, is out now from Torrey House Press. He'll be at the Montrose Pavilion on Tuesday, April 7th. Doors at 6:30, shows at 7. Tickets at sherboneau.org. And Preserved, the film, is making the rounds all over the U.S. Check out preservedproductions.com for upcoming screenings. If you joined us midstream today, find the full episode under the news tab at kvnf.org by looking for Local Motion there, or search KVNF Local Motion on Spotify. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks so much for listening.